We're looking at the life of David. Or before I start, by the way, I'm away preaching this coming week, and I'll be away next Monday, so that there won't be a Bible class next Monday. So God willing, there'll be one a fortnight tonight. So that if you don't listen to announcements, like I don't listen very often, you'll remember my telling you now. We're in 1 Samuel 31. I think I should have said 1 Samuel 30. Right. We're going through so many chapters, really, but still there's plenty ahead of us. Looking at the character of David, who was one day to be king, I don't think that at any time after his anointing did David doubt that he would be king. And although he shows generosity of heart towards Saul, I think that's knowledge in his heart that there would be nothing really at the end of the day that would stop him. Although there are times when, remember, he despaired and he sinned and he said, surely that he would be killed at the hand of Saul. To understand David, you must remind yourself all the while of the time when he had been anointed and when he had been in Saul's court as a songster and a harpist. And when he went back from the court to the slopes of Bethlehem, back again to be a shepherd. And where we believe that great psalm was given to him by God, the Lord is my shepherd. And that it is impossible for us to think in any way that a person is not a believer who wrote a psalm like that. And also to remember that our Saviour, who was from the point of view of his lineage on earth, came from the family of David. And we sing, don't we, we know in scriptures, a greater than David. And also that he took the illustration of David. David was a shepherd, and Jesus Christ said, I am the good shepherd. And there may be other reasons why he chose to be known as a shepherd, but that surely is one very good reason. That he is the good shepherd that David is really singing about in Psalm 23. Now that is his basic experience. And at the beginning, you know, the wisdom of God was upon him. And this endless antagonism by Saul, endless pursuit, brought great sorrow to him. And we know how the times he shows disobedience. But the main thing that we learn so far is this, that when he seeks the face of God for advice, he does well. And when he does not seek the face of God, he goes back again. So that is really what we see. And the dealings of God in the soul of a man, all the while God is preparing this man to be a king, some king, to be a great king, a greater king than Israel had ever known. It didn't look very often when you looked at this man. You might say, well, I don't think that God will do anything with this material. But then we could say that, couldn't we? If we look perhaps into the lives, or take the life of the Apostle Paul. If we are looking at the material of Saul, of Tarsus, before he came to the Lord, persecuting, speaking against them so that they were put to death as Christian people. And yet all the while God was dealing with that man's soul. And you might say, well, we don't see any material there of a great apostle to the Gentiles. And yet God made him so. That's the remarkable thing. If he can create out of nothing, he can certainly do something out of what we are. Now then, he does two things, and if we could read them at the same time, they would run together. He is dealing with David now in a pretty positive way. But he is also finally dealing with Saul. Finally dealing with him. And if I may ask you to recall in your minds that every time that David had an opportunity or his followers to kill Saul, he said, touch not the Lord's anointed. And then he said, the only way that Saul can be dealt with is whether he should be, God should kill him and he should die suddenly, or that he should die in any case of some illness or another, or that he should be met squarely in battle and killed. But otherwise, touch not the Lord's anointed. And he had every reason to kill him, and yet he did not. Now, that's the kind of background that we're familiar with. But David really went far. He went to live in the land of the Philistines. Now, of all places to go. Now, when he went there, Saul no longer chased after him, but left him alone. And David killed many of the enemies of Israel, and who would have been supporters of the Philistines, but deceived too by killing them all so there would be nobody to tell the story. Perhaps his motive was a good one. It may well have been. But nevertheless, he swears allegiance to the king of Ziklag, the king Achish, isn't it? He swears allegiance to him, so much so that that man truly believes in David as a supporter. So when they decide to go to battle against Saul and against Israel, to our horror, we find that David is willing to go to battle and kill the men of Israel. Now then we might say, maybe he was only pretending. Maybe he would suddenly turn on the Philistines. But we can only say those are maybes. What the Bible tells us is that he gave his word and led his men to do this. We never sin alone. That's the frightening thing. When, as Christians, we wander away from God, we take many others down with us. We may not know all the ones we take down. We may know some. But here, all these men, 600 men that he had, and their families and children, he was committing them to being against the children of God, against the church of God. Now, God sometimes can save us in remarkable ways, you know, outstanding ways. A hand can come from an unexpected quarter, an unexpected one. And so it is the Philistine princes, when they speak to Achish, they say, and do you know who he is? He is the one that they said, Saul has killed his thousands, but David has killed his tens of thousands. He is the one that's called Goliath. Who is this Goliath? Who is this Philistine that he should insult the Lord God of Israel? He is the one that killed Goliath. And you mean to tell me that you can trust this man? And so they insisted that he went back to Ziklag. And Achish was very sorry about this because he trusted him. And David was disappointed, very disappointed. And so he went back. So the dilemma, if it was a dilemma, I'm not sure. Anyway, it was decided for him what he should do. God would not allow him to fight against the people of God. See, he's a believer. A believer may think he can go as far as he likes. He can go far in his backsliding, but not as far as he likes. There is a restraining hand of God that will be upon him. Once saved, caught forever. And so it was with him. Now there is a hand of God there. Now David's return to Ziklag is a disappointing one. They are going now back there. He's disappointed because he's got to go back anyway. And he's going back, at least they will see their wives and their children. And I'll just read you the verses 2, 3, 4 in chapter 30. And had taken the women, verse 1. And it came to pass when David and his men were come to Ziklag on the third day, that the Amalekites had invaded the south, and Ziklag, and smitten Ziklag, and burned it with fire, and had taken the women captives that were therein. They slew not any, either great or small, but carried them away and went on their way. So David and his men came to the city, and behold, it was burned with fire, and their wives and their sons and their daughters were taken captives. Then David and the people that were with him lifted up their voice and wept until they had no more power to weep. Now, we understand that kind of thing, don't we? That there are times in all our lives when we have had some great sorrow and it seems as if we have wept so much that there is no more power left to weep. And David's two wives were taken captives, and David was greatly distressed, for the people spake of stoning him, because the soul of all the people was grieved, every man for his sons and for his daughters. But David encouraged himself in the Lord. Now, this is an astounding thing. The apparent possible death of the wives and children did not bring David back to God. Now, when God brings us back, he will invite us back. Then if we don't come back, then he deals with us. I think the history of the Christian church will show that all along, as individuals or as churches, where a church has gone away, a believing church, that he will deal with that person or with that church. And so he deals with these people that have gone with David as well. And in dealing with them, you would have thought, now here is the hand of God. He's delivered him from opposing the church, Israel. He's delivered him from that. And he should be grateful. But he's not grateful, he's disappointed. And so when he comes to the city in Gath, the Philistines, the city of Achish, when they discover that they weep, yes, he weeps enough, but they weep because they weep for their loved ones. But it did not bring him back to God. The amazing thing is, what brought him back to God when his own friends turned on him and would have stoned him. That shook him. He never thought that those who had supported him against Israel and to be with him with the Philistines, he never thought that those who took his word as being absolute and correct and they would not leave him, wherever he went they would go without question, he never thought that they would talk of stoning him in their bitter grief in losing their loved ones. It shook him. It took that. It's an amazing thing, it took that. What does David do? Well, this is what he does. Now, here is a phrase where you have to read into it a great deal, not speculation by any means. It is a powerful phrase. But David encouraged himself in the Lord his God. Now then, how can a man encourage himself in the Lord his God when he has been disobedient for a considerable time, when he has caused others to sin, and when he's brought sorrow upon the family of the priest in the previous chapters? When he's done that, the only redeeming feature that you can see in him is that he spared the Lord's anointed, that he would not sin in that way. Yet he is encouraged in the Lord. You can't be encouraged in the Lord and just say, here I am, I've sinned right up to now, now Lord, I'll encourage myself in thee. It never works like that. You can't. It's impossible. If a backslider thinks for one moment and all he has to do is to say, right up to the moment, say, let's call it in moments, moment 10, I am a strong, powerful backslider. And in moment 10, my friends turn against me, and it causes me to seek God. And in moment 11, I am encouraging God. It's nonsense. It could never happen, not in anyone's experience. God isn't cheap. There's nothing cheap about God. There would be conviction. You see, David, this is where you learn what happened there. The description of David is that he is a man after God's heart, basically. So, because he is that, when he sins, he is all the while he's tormented. Even when he's very disobedient, he's not happy and he's not at peace. When he's like that. And so there would be conviction, and there must be conviction when a person is coming back. They must be convinced of their wrong. Now, remember, I know we use the word sin and evil interchangeably, but we don't sin against one another. We sin against God. And we do evil against one another. You know, it's quite a distinction. The only person we can sin against is God. The verse that I could quote to you, "Against thee only have I done this sin," and then, in the circumstances, "and this evil in thy sights." We commit evil against one another, but it is sin that it is against God. There must be a conviction that he has been wrong, and a sorrow in it as well. There must be a contrition of heart, a brokenness that is unmistakably genuine. Because this idea that we can just flop back to God when we're like is nonsense. You know, and if we have that thought, he will leave us in our hardness and give us our heart desires and send leanness to our souls. Contrition and confession, those must be there. Where he confesses his wrong to God. That would have to be there. In Proverbs 28 verse 13 we have these words. He that covereth his sins shall not prosper. But whoso confesseth and forsaketh them shall have mercy. It's Proverbs 28 verse 13. He that covereth his sins, as if he hadn't committed them, shall not prosper, but whoso confesseth and forsaketh them shall have mercy. And it would be on that, and David would know that, as the author of these remarkable psalms as well, he would know that. And so he can say, yes, because of that he is encouraged in the Lord. Because you could hardly be right in that encouragement in the mess that he is in. And in the disappointments and the sorrows and how he must have despised himself. And so we come then to God dealing with him. Now, immediately there is a change in his behavior. What shall he do? Now then, hitherto, for a while, he had done what he thought was the reasonable and the sensible thing in his sight, what he wanted, what he wished. He wouldn't dream of seeking God in these occasions. But here he does, in verses 9 and 10. So David, verse 7 and 8. "And David said to Abiathar the priest, Ahimelech's son, I pray thee, bring me hither the ephod. And Abiathar brought the ephod to David. And David inquired of the Lord, saying, Shall I pursue after this troop?" Now these people that have destroyed their families. "Shall I overtake them?" And he answered him, "Pursue. For thou shalt surely overtake them, and without fail recover all." He's told that before he goes. That he shall recover all without fail. So David went, he and the 600 men that were with him, and came to the brook Besor, where those that were left behind stayed. David pursued, he and 400 men, for 200 abode behind, which were so faint that they could not go over the brook Besor. So now then, you might say, well, this is God testing his faith here. He is, know that a mighty lot of these Amalekites have come, and sacked the city, taken all the people away, and he's after them. And he's only got 600 men. And to think that 200 of them say, well, they just can't make it. We're just absolutely washed out. We just can't. We're weary. Can't go any further. We can't cross that brook even. So leave us here. So he went on with 400. A little bit like Gideon, where he brings down the numbers. And they found, they saw a young man. And here is where God gives a light to his path. When he is doing right, you can see the hand of God all along. And they found an Egyptian in the field and brought him to David and gave him bread. And he did eat and they made him drink water. Now he's still being tested. And they gave him a piece of cake, of figs, two clusters of raisins. And when he had eaten, his spirit came again to him, for he had eaten no bread nor drunk any water 3 days and three nights. And David said unto him, To whom belongest thou? And whence art thou? And he said, I am a young man of Egypt, a servant to an Amalekite. And my master left me because 3 days ago I fell sick. So he wasn't actually in that battle, or rather in the sacking of Ziklag. Now David could have killed him. Just as an example, we made an invasion upon the south and the coast which belongs to Judah, and upon the south of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag with fire. And David said unto him, Canst thou bring me to this company? And he said, Swear unto me by God, that thou wilt neither kill me, nor deliver me into the hands of my master, and I will bring thee down to this company. And when he had brought him down, behold, they were spread abroad upon the earth, eating and drinking and dancing, because of all the great spoil that they had taken out of the land of the Philistines and out of the land of Judah. Now, he doesn't kill this young man. Then, in verses 19 and 20, And there was nothing lacking to them, neither small, now he has a great victory over them, and there was nothing lacking to them, neither small nor great, neither sons nor daughters, neither spoils, nor anything that they had taken to them. David recovered all. Now then, it is interesting what happened then. Some of the men then become very angry, thinking that he is going to share with the 200. Well, he shows great justice, which became a law in Israel. Not only did they all have a portion because they were his men, but also he sent gifts to many parts of Israel. Now, that's that account there. Something is happening to David. He had to be rescued. You could say he was being driven by his own anger, his own sin. He was being driven along a way that eventually was causing him to oppose the people of God. You might say that could never happen to a Christian. Well, it does do. We can go that we can feel that we oppose even the people of God. But God will not let us go far in that. So God stopped him. Thus far, no further. Then he deals with him. He's very scared when he sees all are lost. And when he's threatened, at last he comes to himself. And then we have the contrition and the confession. We have that he's encouraged in the Lord. Then he seeks the will of God. Then he's helped along the way, although he has less men, which tests him. And he's merciful to this young man. He deals with the enemies of both Israel and Philistia and recovers their families, and he shows that he's sharing. Now that's what we have there. That's the God dealing with him. Now God now is dealing with Saul, and here is where Saul makes his departure. In Hosea 13 verse 11, there's a verse that says, I gave them a king in mine anger and took him away in my wrath. Now that is a description of Hosea speaking of the time of Samuel when the children of Israel wanted a king like other nations, and it was not really God's desire for them. It wasn't God's best for them. And very often God's people will not go for his best, but will go for secondary things. Indeed, there was a lot to commend Saul. He was a big man. He was a strong man. He was, in his day, a popular man. There was certainly plenty about him that was meant that he was an attractive leader and a great warrior. So there's a great deal to be said in those days regarding Saul. And he did get rid of all those who practiced with evil spirits and familiar spirits in those early days. Yet at his lowest, he sought the advice of a witch. That's the amazing thing. That's how low he went. Now what is this man's end? There is a battle against Saul. But chapter 31. Now the Philistines fought against Israel, and the men of Israel fled from the Philistines and fell down slain in Mount Gilboa. And the Philistines followed hard upon Saul and upon his sons, and the Philistines slew Jonathan and Abinadab and Malchishua, Saul's sons. And the battle went sore against Saul, and the archers hit him, and he was sore wounded of the archers. Then said Saul unto his armor bearer, draw thy sword, and thrust me through therewith, lest these uncircumcised come and thrust me through and abuse me. But his armor bearer would not, for he was sore afraid. Therefore Saul took a sword and fell upon it. And when his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, now notice he is dead, it wouldn't be in scripture otherwise, he fell likewise upon his sword and died with him. He died in battle. Died in battle. Now, some terrible things happen. So Saul died, and his three sons, and his armor bearer, and all his men that same day together. And when the men of Israel that were on the other side of the valley, and they that were on the other side of Jordan, saw that the men of Israel fled, and that Saul and his sons were dead, they forsook the cities and fled, and the Philistines came and dwelt in them. It seems now that the end, all that Saul has given to Judah, to the children of Israel, all that he's given is that they should be inhabited by the Philistines. That seems to be all that he leaves his people. And it came to pass on the morrow, when the Philistines came to strip the slain, that they found Saul and his three sons fallen in Mount Gilboa. And they cut off his head and stripped off his armor and sent it to the land of the Philistines round about to publish it in the house of their idols and among the people. And they put his armor in the house of Ashtoreth, and they fastened his body to the wall of Bethshan. And when the inhabitants of Jabesh Gilead heard of that which the Philistines had done to Saul, all the valiant men arose and went all night and took the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons from the wall of Bethshan, and came to Jabesh and burnt them there. And they took their bones and buried them under a tree of Jabesh and fasted 7 days. And so you know that many of his men honored him in that way. That's the end of Saul. That's the end of Saul. But King David hasn't heard yet. Or rather, David hasn't heard. And so now we come back to David. And remember his great love as a friend to Jonathan. He doesn't meet him all that often, but nevertheless, when he met him, they were kindred spirits. And there's some violence in this too, and yet there's some beauty in this chapter. See, here is a man on the way back to God. Here is a man who now regrets the life that he has lived. Here is a man that's still able to say, the Lord is my shepherd. It came even to pass on the third day that, behold, a man came out of the camp from Saul with his clothes rent and earth upon his head. And so it was when he came to David that he fell on the earth and did obeisance. And David said unto him, from whence comest thou? And he said unto him, out of the camp of Israel am I escaped. And David said unto him, how went the matter? I pray thee, tell me. And he answered, that the people are fled from the battle, and many of the people also are fallen and dead, and Saul and Jonathan his son are dead also. And David said unto the young man that told him, how knowest thou that Saul and Jonathan his son be dead? And the young man that told him said, as I happened by chance upon Mount Gilboa, behold, Saul leaned upon his spear, and lo, the chariots of the horsemen followed hard after him. And when he looked behind him, he saw me, and called unto me, and I answered, here am I. And he said unto me, who art thou? And I answered him, I am an Amalekite. He said unto me again, stand, I pray thee, upon me, and slay me, for anguish has come upon me, because my life is yet whole in me. So I stood upon him, and slew him, because I was sure that he could not live after that he was fallen. And I took the crown that was upon his head, and the bracelet that was on his arm, and have brought them hither unto my Lord. And this man is lying. He's just taken what he found. Then David took hold on his clothes and rent them, and likewise all the men that were with him. And they mourned and wept and fasted until even, for Saul and for Jonathan his son. and for the people of the Lord, for the house of Israel, because they were fallen by the sword. You see, here you can see a different attitude. Here are men now, not going out to battle against Israel, but who are breaking their hearts and mourning for the dead of Israel. They're mourning for the losses that have taken place amongst the people of God. And David said unto the young man that told him, "Whence art thou?" And he answered, "I am the son of a stranger, an Amalekite." And David said unto him, "How wast thou not afraid to stretch forth thine hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" Now, whether it is true or not, I don't suppose David knew. We know, because we know from Scripture that he was dead, as far as David was concerned. You see, he held that still. He knew Saul was not a good king. He knew he was once quite a great king, but he was the Lord's anointed, and he would not raise his hand against the Lord's anointed. And so here we find him shocked that this man should do this. And David called one of the young men and said, "Go near and fall upon him." And he smote him that he died. And David said unto him, "Thy blood be upon thy head, for thy mouth hath testified against thee, saying, I have slain the Lord's anointed." And David lamented with his lamentation over Saul and over Jonathan his son. Now then, we come then to a part that is so very remarkable. There's the story. And David having the news of Saul's death. And you can well imagine, he may have been, who's able to say, that he may have been glad that the pursuit was over. Yet on the other hand, he wanted no parts in opposing the one God had chosen. It may be that it was because partly he was very sure that he would be king. And yet he wasn't so sure on times, because he did think that Saul would be the end of him. So I would believe that his motive was a pure one, in that he would not harm the Lord's anointed. Well then, we see a sorrow for Saul and for Jonathan. Then there's a kind of, it's a song here and words, and there is so much to be learnt here. Look at verse 19. How many times have we quoted one or two of these phrases in this little section that closes his laments for the fallen of Israel and for Jonathan? The beauty of Israel is slain upon thy high places. How are the mighty fallen? How many times have we used that? You know, when you think sometimes of our land here, I heard the other day of two Calvinistic Methodist Welsh churches that I knew well in Swansea, near to one another, that they were not there anymore. They had recently been taken down. And they were quite well-known churches when I was in Pontarddulais. And a very big evangelical Baptist church, Welsh, they were all Welsh churches, with only 10 attending it now. I could hardly believe it. And then I remember John Glynn telling me that in the area of Wenfawr, which had many large churches, and they all used to be full, very well attended, not so very long ago, the six have been taken down. Now, you know, there's one place along the North Wales coast called Velin Heli. Now, as you go through it, there's a very attractive looking chapel. It's been for sale for years and years and years. I think some public house in the Midlands has bought all the furniture, the pews. They queue up to get the woodwork from these chapels because they make attractive seats in public houses. Terrible thing. So we hear, you know, those are only little snippets, aren't they? So we hear of all these things. These were places where God was honoured. These were places where the people of that area who are still there, and many of them who used to attend, yet their footsteps no longer take them there. And churches that were known throughout the land. Really now. I can think of names of churches that the present generation would not even have heard of them, such as their desolation. How are the mighty fallen? It is an astounding thing. And so he's asking this. The beauty of Israel is slain upon thy high places. And we live in a country that had the beauty of Israel upon her. You know, remarkable. The 1904 revival, yes, it was a great revival. But it was only, you might say, a revival that seemed to be after a long series of revivals in any case. It wasn't just a revival on its own. There had been so many, a great one in 1859, not so very long before then, but many in between. Many. The beauty of Israel was in the land. How are the mighty fallen? Tell it not in Gath. Don't tell the Philistines. Don't let them know what has happened to Israel. Don't let them believe what's happened to them. I'm trying to think of one of Doddridge's hymns where the awakening must have started. Let's see if I can get it straight away. I think I can remember the number. Here it is. Triumphant Zion. And so blessing must have come. But listen to this particular verse. When blessing comes, no more shall foes unclean invade and fill thy hallowed walls with dread. No more shall hell's insulting host their victory and thy sorrows boast. It's a very rich line, isn't it? Well, they've been boasting of their victory and they've been boasting of your sorrows. So he said, whisper it not in Gath. Don't tell the Philistines that they might be able to boast of their victory and the sorrows of the people of God. Now that's a situation, you see, that David is in. Saul is dead. But you might well say, so was Israel. The people have fled, was left of them. The mighty men of valor have been killed. Most of them, he and his rabble are still there, and the towns and the cities are filled with the Philistines. How are the mighty fallen? Tell it not in Gath, publish it not in the street of Ascalon, lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised triumph. In mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew, neither let there be rain upon you, nor fields of offerings, for there the shield of the mighty is vilely cast away, the shield of Saul, as though he had not been anointed, as though he had not been anointed with oil. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan turned not back, and the sword of Saul returned not empty. And then he refers to his love and his friendship to Jonathan. Saul and Jonathan were lovely and pleasant in their lives, and in their death they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles, they were stronger than lions. Ye daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you in scarlet with other delights, who put on ornaments of gold upon your apparel. How are the mighty fallen in the midst of the battle? You can almost fear here that we've got the true David back, haven't we? He's back at last. He's back from his wanderings. His wandering days seem to have, at the moment, to come to a close. How are the mighty fallen in the midst of the battle? O Jonathan, thou hast slain in thy high places. I am distressed for thee, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant hast thou been unto me. Thy love to me was more wonderful, passing the love of women. How are the mighty fallen, and the weapons of war perished. It's very beautiful, isn't it? In a very kind of solemn, sorrowful way. It's a most glorious lament. And where he looks upon Israel, upon his king Saul, and the son Jonathan. How are the mighty fallen? What has happened to Israel? And we too, you say, might say something like that. Well, how are the mighty fallen within our land? What has happened to God's people? And that there might be a longing too in our hearts as we look. And almost a lament at the moment, you know, that what we might say, well, of course we rejoice in our salvation. But also, although we rejoice in our salvation, yet we deplore the state that things are today. In Psalm 37, it's one of the great inclusive psalms of David. I don't know when he wrote it, but I'm inclined to think it must have been well on in his life. And I was thinking of these verses. You could think of him that when Saul was pursuing him. Verse 10, for yet a little while, and the wicked shall not be. Yea, thou shalt diligently consider his place, and it shall not be. That there would be a time. Now, he's praising Saul here, but we know that Saul was no good for Israel. We know that he brought great sorrow and distress upon Israel and restored these familiar spirits and so on. And so we might say, well, will he ever go? For yet a little while, and the wicked shall not be. Yea, thou shalt diligently consider his place, and it shall not be. I don't think that David could see it, you see. Saul was such a powerful king, and with one time he had 3,000, is he coming after him? A big army at that time, probably had far more as well. And he's a good warrior. He did not fear anybody. Yet he has lost now, and you couldn't find him. Where is he? He was so powerful in his words, so vindictive in his actions, that he was no longer to be seen. Then in verse 34, wait on the Lord, is his advice. Wait on the Lord and keep his way, and he shall exalt thee to inherit the land. When the wicked are cut off, thou shalt see it. He was as if he was looking forward at that time, in a way, or looking back and recalling it, and saying, wait on the Lord, even though it seems pretty desolate now, and yet it shall happen. I have seen, he said, it's my experience. So he's looking back, isn't he? It's my experience, he said. Not only in the time of Saul, but I'm sure with the Philistines too. I have seen the wicked in great power. See the Philistines, it could refer to that. I have seen the wicked in great power, and spreading himself like a green bay tree. They were everywhere. Wherever you looked, they were there. They seemed to populate the land. And we can describe it as, we can see today, the wicked like a green bay tree. They're in charge of everything. They're in charge of the media. They're in charge of everything that we read and see. Every bit of news is coloured by this. Everything that comes to us, they are everywhere. We are fed by them in every possible way. In every direction we look in our cities, they are everywhere. Their methods are in nearly every business in the land, and their ways, they are everywhere. Their standards are everywhere, in everything and in every department of our lives. I have seen the wicked in great power, and spreading himself like a green bay tree, very confident. Yet, he passed away, and lo, he was not. I sought him, but he could not be found. You can give many examples. Take the early church. Take the many persecutions. If you want to pick on one, take the Neronian persecution. And the terrible times that the Christians suffered. And the Roman Empire was perhaps one of the greatest that has ever been. But where is she today? You know, those little handful of Christians wandering from town to town, their churches here and there, easy prey and fun for persecution. And you might say, who's going to win? Will it be Rome? Or will it be these men who were so feeble and so frail from the point of view of the strength of men? And yet where are they today? But the city of God remaineth. And we could say the same. For any ideology or any worldly way that is in any of the countries or system that we have, they spread themselves like a big bay tree. And you might say, the church of God, is she going to survive? Will she keep the Lord's Day even? Will she be able to just hang on to that last little thing by the grace of God? We can be concerned about that, but we needn't be concerned about the ultimate. Yet he passed away, and lo, he was not. Yea, I sought him, but he could not be found. Such is the church of God. Yes, we can have things that are problems for a while, and we should say what we believe, but we needn't be in a panic like other peoples are in panic, because we know that although a little skirmish may apparently be won by the world, the battle is not ours, but his. And the gates of hell shall not prevail against his church. Yet it passed away, and lo, he was not. Yea, I sought him, but he could not be found. Shall we pray?